Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. Two guests today. First, in moments, the political scientist Lester Spence will discuss a new paper by the Harvard economist Roland Fryer, which creatively claims that black people are less likely to be shot by cops than white people. And at the bottom of the hour, journalist Aaron Bastani recaps the madness that British politics has become. First, Lester Spence, who teaches political science at Johns Hopkins. The other day, the Upshot column of the New York Times wrote up a new paper by Harvard economist Roland Fryer. It's a preliminary thing for the National Bureau of Economic Research, which pumps out about 20 of them a week. As we'll hear in the interview, Fryer approaches the problem like the neoclassical economist he is, by building elaborate mathematical models to explain individual behavior. It has little of the rich detail that a study by, say, a sociologist or a political scientist might. Though, sad to say, many in those disciplines are now aspiring to the high math that characterizes economics. Fryer's basic findings are that lower-level police contacts with civilians, from stopping and questioning to varieties of manhandling, are fraught with racial bias. Blacks and Latinos are far more likely to be harassed and roughed up than whites. But, and here's the controversial bit, Fryer finds that blacks and Latinos are less likely to be shot by cops than whites. Obviously, this result pleases many powerful people, and the media love a story that looks superficially bold and counterintuitive, but actually reinforces the status quo. How did Fryer get to this conclusion, and does it hold up to scrutiny? Here's Lester Spence, who was on this show in March to discuss his book Knocking the Hustle, An Examination of Black Neoliberalism, with some answers. Welcome, Lester. First, a few words about Roland Fryer himself. Who is he?
So Roland Fryer is a professor of economics at Harvard, and he's probably, he's one of the best economists of his generation, if not the best. Many people think of him as one of the best economists of his generation.
But he's really quite the Chicago School kind of guy, right? He works with the Freakonomics guys and stuff like that.
Yes. He has basically made his career off of using large data sets to make, to justify kind of counterintuitive arguments, or in some cases to kind of justify, provide support for, intuitive arguments, right? About whether it's about kind of black educational outcomes, whether it's about the effect of charter schools, or the effect of teacher quality, and I guess in this case, police killings or police interactions with black folk.
Yeah, well, a lot of these Freakonomics guys, they like to think of themselves as contrarians, but they're actually just refuting what they like to think of as political correctness.
Yes, that's exactly it. So the story comes out, and it's like, oh my God, I've got this really, really startling claim. I never expected to see this in a million years. Police officers are less likely to kill black people than they are whites. Yes.
Well, that is certainly counterintuitive. And there's actually a sentence in the Fryer paper where he said, was it black officers are more likely to kill white people?
Yeah.
I mean, I hope the white supremacists don't discover that one.
Yeah. We need to hire less black. This is proof we need to hire. We need to have less diverse police forces.
Right, yes. This is. Wow, that's counterintuitive, man. All right, so this paper made a big splash. There are several elements to it, so let's go through what he did. He worked with several data sets. One, the New York City Stop and Frisk program. Another, a survey of the public, but done by the Bureau of Justice Statistics. And then some materials that police departments submitted to him. Let's go through these in turn. He looked at the New York City Stop and Frisk data. What did that look like?
What he basically found was that police officers were far more likely to engage in heavy-handed policing on black subjects than white subjects. That's pretty much a straightforward finding. It's important to note, though, that he found a precinct-level variation. That is, there were differences within between precincts within New York, that means suggesting that some precincts were better than others. And I think that's really important when it comes to analyzing the kind of controversial claim.
But he really doesn't know what makes one precinct different from another, does he?
No, because he's really more interested in kind of individual level interactions. And this is a function of his training as an economist, as a Chicago School economist, where institutions as institutions and laws and policies don't really play that great significant of a role in his analysis. So in this case, he actually just controls for police precinct stuff, right? That's how we know there's variance. He just controls for it. He's like, listen, there's these differences between precincts. So we're going to control for that just to see whether if you control for the precinct stuff, individual interactions look one way versus the other.
Yeah, well, he does control for an awful lot. It makes me think that, to paraphrase Joan Robinson on another issue, it looks the way he's controlling away a lot of interesting material.
Yes, yes, that's exactly what he's doing. But in this case, in the New York data set, it's basically so egregious that it doesn't matter how many controls you throw at it, you're still going to have these substantive differences. It's important to note that in New York, they've in effect stopped and frisked like more black people than there are citizens in the city of New York. So you're talking about probably one of the most egregious cases in the country. So you're not going to be able to control away that individual level interaction because it's so arguably deeply ingrained in police officers, whether they're black, white, or Latino or Asian, whether they're male or female, whether they've got 100 years in the force or 2 months.
Yeah, you know, I don't know any white people ever stopped by the cops. I never have been. You know, it's a totally different world we live in here.
It's one of the blessings of the video. Well, it's a complicated blessing, right? But one of the blessings of all this video we're seeing is that people can no longer discount, like whites who have almost no negative interactions with police on average, they can no longer disbelieve the number of black folk, including me, who say, well, you know what? No, my police encounters are usually fraught.
Yeah, I've been stopped by a cop 3 times in my life, and I was speeding every time.
yeah, but it's not only that, right? So yes, A, you did something wrong, but then B, I'm imagining those encounters were just kind of mundane, right?
Yeah, like, I mean, the last time the New York State Trooper was kind of nasty.
Yeah. So by contradistinction, I've actually had recently over the past several years, that is on the other side of 40, more or less. I had one encounter with a police officer where I didn't have my license. I didn't have photo ID. I didn't even know whose car I was driving, and I didn't get a ticket. So in my case, that's like, oh my God, this must be what it's like to be white, because I think given my race, I was supposed to go to jail, and I think I was supposed to be beaten up.
But if you're 20 or 25 years younger, that's...
Oh, yes. Oh, it would have been a very, very different circumstance. Very different case.
Okay, now back to the study. Then there's the survey that BJS does. What did he find with that?
He found more or less the same thing, that at a national level, that you're talking about police interactions with black citizens, with black and brown citizens are more fraught than encounters with white ones.
But then when we really get counterintuitive when we move on to the police department data. So he got some data from police departments. Tell us about that.
Yeah. So what he did was he did an intensive, and it's really important to note that the work he put in this paper, I disagree strongly with these, with the findings, but the labor involved in collecting the data, in Houston and a number of other places, I believe in Florida and Texas, is really intensive. I mean, really, 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 really intensive. I think he collected he coded maybe 300 variables on each encounter. And then what the most controversial stuff, it comes from a subset of data collected in Houston. He did really, really deep dive coding almost every aspect of an encounter to see whether a police officers more likely to discharge a weapon against a black than a white, and against a Latino than a white.
And this is nicely euphemized as officer-involved shootings, OIS.
Yes, yes.
And this is where we get really counterintuitive, right, with his results?
Yeah, because the results show that to the extent there is a statistically significant difference, it actually goes the other way, where police officers are actually less likely to shoot black than a white. Yeah, that's the startling finding. Now, it's important to note that with this whole paper, this paper has actually not been peer reviewed. So the usual process for listeners who may not be academics, who may not know academics, is you send a paper to a journal. The paper is anonymized. So the journal gets the paper. They strip all the names and identifying stuff from the paper. And then they send it to a series of reviewers, like maybe 3 to 5 reviewers. Now, the person who wrote the paper, the people who wrote the paper don't know the reviewers. The reviewer don't know the people who wrote the paper. And then they basically go over the paper with a fine-tooth comb, and they say they make one of 3 decisions. They either say, the individuals say, either the paper is accepted, that is, it meets the standards of social science, and it meets the qualities of the journal should be published. Either it should go back for more review, or it should be rejected, and then the editor makes the decision. That whole process, this paper hasn't undergone that. So when he talks about findings, before we even get to the nature of the findings, it's important to note this paper has not been peer-reviewed. And then secondarily, and then this does begin to get to the nature of the findings, is that the Houston data, he's articulating the Houston data as if it's a national-level finding. When even if the finding holds, we can only say that's true among in Houston. I think there's serious problems with the finding, but we can only say it applies in Houston.
And before we get to those serious problems you have, this is a working paper. The National Bureau of Economic Research publishes thousands of these working papers. A lot of them get taken seriously by journalists, even though they have not been peer-reviewed. This thing, you know, it didn't even get its copy edited. There are, like, some strange non-sentences in it. It has a, you know, just from reading it, it has a bit of a sloppy feel. But, you know.
Yeah, kind of like the first version of my book.
Yeah, we all don't want to see the first versions of anything necessarily in the public. This paper, and you got an unusually large play in the New York Times, which is why everyone is talking about it and thinking about it, which is why I asked you to come on and talk about it, because you know, a lot of people see this in an article, see it in a headline. You know, in these days of social media, people read a headline, don't bother to read the article, much less the original paper, much less think about the whole peer review process that didn't even happen to this thing yet. But, you know, people look at this and say, oh, gosh, you know, this whole Black Lives Matter thing is a bunch of nonsense.
Yes. Yes.
So that is the danger of this paper and this, that we're doing our bit to try to head off. Okay, so what are your problems with his findings in Houston? Like, leaving aside the issue of how nationally representative that is.
There are a couple of really, really important critiques. So the first is that it doesn't take contextual data into account, right? So we know that there's a great deal of variance in police shootings. Right. We know that the number in Houston may not be the number in Des Moines, Iowa, may not be the number in Portland, Oregon, that politics matters. So I mentioned that precinct level stuff that he kind of controls for in the New York case. That precinct level stuff aggregated up, that city level stuff actually matters. The police dynamic is not simply a matter of individual encounters with citizens. It's also the function of public policy, right? To when a city like Ferguson uses its police officers to basically collect municipal revenue. So policing in Ferguson is going to be different than a city that actually doesn't have that dynamic. And we know that in a city like New York, they've actually created policy designed to aggressively deal with citizens. In this case, it's less to collect revenue, although New York does collect, like, I think $8 million a month from this stuff. But anytime you've got a set of policies in place, that's going to influence the types of encounters police have with citizens. Roland Fryer doesn't take that into account at all. And then secondarily, by looking at the encounters themselves, Roland Fryer ignores the whole set of stuff that happens leading up to the police encounter, right? So the question isn't just, if we think about it theoretically, it's not just, okay, given this encounter with police, given this encounter that may go bad with this with a suspect, am I going to use deadly force or not? It's, am I going to stop this guy in the first place?
I'm speaking with Lester Spence, Associate Professor of Political Science and Africana Studies at Johns Hopkins. It's interesting that you can see the marks of his training as an economist in this, because this reminds me very much of the way economists study labor market discrimination.
That's it.
They look just at the market. So, like, you have a black guy who and a white guy in the same profession, a white woman and a black woman in the same profession. After controlling for everything else, is the pay of the woman and the black person lower than that of the white man, you know? then they look at nothing that else that leads up to that situation. Like what they call pre-market discrimination is just assumed away. So it sounds very much like he's doing the same thing here with the shooting data.
Yeah, that's exactly what he's doing. So this is the difference between an economics approach to this question and, say, a sociologist approach to this question, or a political science approach to this question, or even an anthropologist approach to this question. There's a paper that I believe has been peer-reviewed by Cody Ross, who's an anthropologist who actually conducts kind of a multi-level model to look at police killings, and he finds that at the county level between 2011 and 2014, there is both significant variation between counties. That is, there's a county level stuff that predicts that's associated with high rates of police killings in one county versus the other, but then also shows in general a really high level of bias in police shootings. And in his case, he actually takes political and economic stuff that's associated with counties, he takes it into his model.
Yeah, is that the one that's a PLOS?
And that was peer-reviewed, right? Now, here's the challenge. The challenge is that the county level is too kind of clunky, a geographic unit. But, you know, it was, so you can argue that, A, he should have done a deeper dive and maybe done municipal level stuff if he could have. And then B, I think the individual level stuff that that Fryer tries to get at is important, but you don't want to ignore, you know, you don't want to start with just the individual level stuff and ignore the county level stuff. If anything, you want to start with the county level stuff that has political data, that has kind of socioeconomic data, like income inequality, and then you want to dig down.
You know, as I recall from, like, the Guardian and Washington Post counts, the most trigger-happy police departments in the country are, like, small and medium-sized cities in the South and West, not big cities like Houston.
Yeah, I mean, Houston is so big, and it's one of those cities that because of really liberal laws about kind of basically gobbling up surrounding towns, it gets bigger every year. Why would you use that?
Well, they gave him the data.
It's like the municipal version of the blob.
Well, they also gave him the data, and New York City didn't give him the data. So
yeah, and then that also is a secondary. Now, this is a bias he actually allows for in the paper. He notes that police who are willing to give him the data, they may be different than police departments who are less likely to give them the data. And I think he's probably right there.
But, you know, but he is trying to locate a lot of this at the level of the individuals you said earlier. What's the problem with that?
So if you take kind of a psychology approach, right, we know that individuals have these attitudes. Some of them are explicit and some of them are implicit. And we know these explicit and implicit attitudes actually shape behavior. Right. So somebody who's using the labor example that economists study often, an employer who has explicit attitudes where the employer doesn't like black people will likely not hire, will hire less of them. Right. Then we know implicit attitudes work. So implicitly, and this is their papers that actually support peer review papers to support this. If an employer sees a file with the name Leroy, an employer sees an application and the name of the person is Leroy Jackson, that employer is going to be less likely to give that application a second call or a look over as opposed to an application that had the exact same stuff, but the name was something else. The name was kind of a innocuous white name. And that could be a matter of implicit attitudes at work. That is, attitudes that the person may not even be aware they have, right? So for those reasons, it's important to understand individual level behavior, because racism works at the individual level. However, there are political and social dynamics and institutional dynamics which actually go beyond what the individual thinks or what their individual attitudes are. And this is why it's important thinking about Fryer's study, where he actually takes the race of the officer into account. This is why policy-wise, it's not enough just to say we need more black police officers, right? That takes kind of an individual-level dynamic into account without looking at institutions. This is why it's important to think about public policy, right? Because we know that discrimination that blacks face and Latinos face is not solely a matter of individuals, but it's also a matter of public policy, which goes beyond individuals.
So what, after reading this Fryer stuff and studying it, what's your conclusion about, you know, the relative risk of black people being shot by cops rather than white people?
my conclusion is that Fryer's finding is wrong. If Fryer were to actually submit the paper to a peer-reviewed journal, it's likely that at best what he'd get is a revise and resubmit. And I think that probably people would really ding him on the really controversial claim. But more broadly, what Fryer's work and Cross's and Ross's work call for is a lot more transparency and a lot more openness in data collection. I mean, so I'm doing my own police study. I'm not interested in police killings per se, but I'm interested in why police spending in Baltimore has increased so much, particularly between 1990 and 2015. And getting data from the police department has been like pulling teeth. I know other scholars who are doing somewhat similar work, and just getting data on this stuff is really, really, really hard. What Fryer's work, what Ross's work shows is, at best, is that we need a lot more people studying this stuff, and this data needs to be a lot more transparent than it is.
He acknowledges this in the paper, and we also mentioned this earlier, but you know, the fact that Houston provided this data makes me wonder, you know, if they knew what it was going to look like.
Again, it's if you're only looking, if you're not looking at the stop itself, it's not just, again, it's not just giving somebody who looks like they might be a threat after you've already stopped them, after you've already reached for your gun, do you shoot or not? I mean, it's like there's a whole set of stuff before that I'm really surprised he didn't look at. I mean, I didn't, at the beginning when you asked me who he was, I really didn't do him justice. He's what, the youngest black person to ever receive tenure at Harvard. He's a MacArthur Fellow. In 2015, I think he won the award for the best economist in the world under 40, right? I expect better from a scholar of his with his background.
Yeah, well, you know, to some degree, that's the way you get the prizes, though, telling people things they want to hear.
Yeah, fair enough. Fair enough, but even though most of his findings actually are politically problematic, but he's still supposed to be a social scientist. Like, I actually believe, and I actually find it funny that I'm saying this as I'm speaking to you. I kind of believe in social science. I kind of believe in peer review. And what we need in this fight to make police more transparent and more democratically accountable, data matters. Research matters, and we need him to be a lot better than what he is. Well, you know, some of our people are just like, you know, there's a deeply American anti-intellectual strain that I want to kind of push back against, even amongst people in our politics, right? They're like, you know, they think about people like Roland as just being in the ivory tower, and that data doesn't matter. People should be on the streets. And I just want to, you know, it's important to note that this stuff is important, it's not just the videotape. It's the data that shows that all these videos we're seeing actually represent a longer pattern or a broader pattern. And we need data to understand this stuff.
That was Lester Spence, an assistant professor of sociology and Africana studies at Johns Hopkins University. He's the author of the book Knocking the Hustle, an examination of black neoliberalism. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back after a musical break.
Bustle, bustle, bustle through.
Some of Bastards in Blue by the Partisans. Next, Aaron Bastani. Over the last few weeks, British politics have become what the Italians call a real casino, a mess, an extravaganza of chaos. There were the Brexit referendum, the resignation of Prime Minister David Cameron, and the internal revolt in the Labour Party against the leadership of Jeremy Corbyn. Corbyn survives for now, but there's a new Prime Minister, Theresa May, who herself opposed Britain leaving the EU, but who has appointed Brexiters, including Boris Johnson, one of the movement's leaders, to senior positions. It's all rather confusing. Here's Aaron Bastani, founder of Novara Media, which in its own words produces video, audio, and text content, which address a variety of social and economic issues viewed as crucial to shaping the 21st century, to sort it all out for us. You've got a new Prime Minister. Tell us about her.
Well, her name's Theresa May. She'll be Britain's second female Prime Minister. She will formally take the job, I believe, on Wednesday evening. A little bit about her. She was responsible for quite a racist anti-immigration campaign. She has definitely contributed to an increasingly xenophobic environment in Britain over the last 6 years. She's been Home Secretary, so that should come as no surprise. That fits, obviously, with the role. And that's both true rhetorically and with policies.
Before going on, what does the Home Secretary do exactly? I don't think we have any corresponding office here.
So over here we have great offices of state. So it's like Foreign Secretary. So that's like your Secretary of State, right?
Yes.
And you have Chancellor and you have, Home Secretary. So those are historically the really important cabinet positions. Now, clearly nowadays, NHS is a huge budget, housing, education, in terms of public salience, these are bigger areas, but those are the historically really important cabinet positions. The Home Secretary basically oversees migration policy, border control, policing, prisons, law and order. So obviously for the Conservatives, it's a real plum position because a Tory Home Secretary can be incredibly retrogressive, authoritarian, and the Conservative membership laps it up.
In the United States, police and prisons and such are mainly state responsibilities, not the central government. But in Britain, these are the responsibility of London.
We've had devolution, obviously, in the last 20 years. That's less the case. Obviously, Britain used to be a very unitary state, overwhelmingly centralised state. So a lot of these competences were with the Home Secretary. The Metropolitan Police Service, which is just London's police service, is ultimately answerable, I believe, to the Home Secretary, even more than the Mayor of London. The Home Secretary certainly has a big role in terms of even the Met. So even when we do have devolution, like to London, that element of the unitary state, highly centralised power, is still very clear.
Okay, so carry on. How is that? She led a racist campaign. What precisely did she do?
Oh, there were like immigration vans and just really nasty. I mean, basically, look, the big force in British politics, now, clearly, post-Brexit as well, two big forces have been the outriders. So you've got the outrider, obviously, the SNP, the Scottish National Party, and the outrider party of UKIP. And now they weren't making big inroads in Westminster elections, obviously, until 2015 with the SNP. They were shaping the conversation generally. So what was the conversation? Well, England and Wales. It was around opposition to membership of the European Union. And it was an increased hostility to migration. So UKIP have really driven that whole thing right, and there was a big concern for the Tories that they would lose voters to UKIP. So 2010, 2011, all the way to the last general election, they'd made policy promises, foremost among them, of course, the promise of a referendum on EU membership, they wouldn't normally have done. And that's also true with things like migration. So for non-EU migrants to come and study in Britain as of 2011, it's incredibly difficult. Incredibly difficult. Now, of course, if you're a free market capitalist, if you're a big business Tory, that doesn't make any sense. You want smart graduates coming here, staying here. But there's a fundamental tension in the Tory party, just as with the Republicans, between a desire for free market capitalism and, of course, the working class base. The working class base has increasingly had an opposition to freedom of movement. So they've tried to reconcile that. And one of the ways they tried to reconcile that was really punishing non-EU students. Almost impossible to come and study over here now. And that was probably her major policy. She was also responsible for 50,000 people with student visas were sent back, and it now transpires they were sent back incorrectly.
But now, May herself was opposed to Brexit?
She was. I mean, she's not a Cameroon. You've got the kind of the Cameroons, they've been called since 2005. David Cameron won the Tory leadership in 2005. has been the leader of his party for 11 years. Quite a success. Not many people get to do that, have that longevity. The Cameroons were seen as a moderate faction within the Tory party. George Osborne, Jeremy Hunt, you could say, a few people around them. Now, clearly, they're not particularly progressive, but they were for things like gay marriage and remaining in the EU. Theresa May, and that's probably why she's leader now, managed to traverse the line between, cross that sort of barrier between the Cameroons and the right of the party. So she was the Home Secretary, like I say. She said some and did some terrible things really around immigration. But she was also very smart around, you know, being friendly to big business, being pro-EU, broadly adopted the same position as Cameron. Remain, but we need to reform it.
The political ironies are amazing. Because Cameron opposed the idea of Brexit. He agreed to the referendum for base political reasons.
Yeah.
The referendum won, even though he expected that it wouldn't. He left. All the leaders of the Brexit movement fell down or stood aside. And here we have a Remain a candidate now becoming the Prime Minister. This is not what people voted for. This is not what a lot in her party want. How can this work out?
Great question. I mean, she'll be. I mean, she was the favourite to win this, but like you say, she was for Remain, and the party base and people that voted Tory in the last general election were overwhelmingly for Leave. What's more, despite the fact that she's been very hostile on non-EU migration in the last 6 years, clearly because we were in the EU, we had massive net migration. And the Tories said that by 2015, this was in 2010, they said by the end of this parliament, by 2015, we would have got immigration down to the tens of thousands. I think last year it was 500,000. So it wasn't that. Okay, so you could have foreseen a situation where Andrea Leadsom, who's just dropped out, could have really attacked May on European migration and on sort of just the Cameroon sort of position she's had. For you know, foremost among them being same-sex marriage. Leadsom said, "Oh, I think Leadsom abstained," but she said she had issues with it as a Christian. I think Leadsom had an outside chance, but of course now we'll never know. But yes, May will be grateful for that because there are real points of divergence between her and between the Tory membership. The Tory membership, look, this is a party of around 100, 120,000 people, the membership. Now, I know that party membership in the States is a bit different, so your listeners may be thinking, well, that's not bad. But the Tories had 3 million members in the 1950s. So for them to have 100,000 people is pretty staggering. What's more, the average member is somewhere in their early 60s. So obviously it's a body of opinion which is out of kilter with the rest of the public. So yes, May will be grateful she wasn't tested in that way and she didn't have to say the kinds of things she would have had to placate them because that would have made her very unpopular with many moderate Tory voters.
Now, there is a wing of the Conservative Party that is for Brexit because they view the EU as a statist institution that's a stone around the neck of big business.
Yeah.
And the populist base is for Brexit for very different reasons, because you know, for sovereignty and nostalgia for British greatness and all those sorts of things. I would presume the British establishment wants to stay mostly in the EU. And so how is she going to finesse this division within her party and do the work of the establishment? She seems not to want to invoke the actual formal process of leaving the EU anytime soon. Is she just going to hope that she can wait around and hope the problem will go away?
God knows. I mean, this is a proper crisis. I mean, that word is used a lot, but this is a proper crisis. And that's why I don't think there'll be a general election. You know, some very lily-livered people on the left, the centre-left, are saying, oh, there'll be a general election. For British capitalism, that would be the worst possible thing right now. There is so much uncertainty, so much risk. It would seem ridiculous. May will go in there, and I think she'll probably... she wants to steady the ship, right? And we don't know what's going to happen with Article 50, but, you know, it does look like the pound against the dollar now is something like, I think it's 120. The euro as well, something like 110. You know, and some people out there, informed people, are saying that the pound, the dollar could go to £1 to $1. So we could have a situation where we go into recession, major currency devaluation. Now, we are a net importer. So you would see a massive increase in consumer prices, not massive, a big increase in consumer prices. You'd see a recession, and that's now being talked about quite openly. Even Nigel Farage said we'd experience a soft recession. So Britain could go into stagflation with rising prices for commodities, with a recession, probably an increase in unemployment. And that's a very difficult situation for a Tory to handle. And whilst the cornerstone of the Tory project for the last 6 years has been deficit reduction and elimination. So in 2010, they said they would get rid of the deficit by 2015. They didn't. It's still massive. You know, it's still something like £70 billion a year. And then in 2015, they said, well, we'll get rid of it by 2020. And then on a rainy Thursday afternoon, I think 2 weeks ago, they said, well, actually, we're not going to get rid of it now. And they said Brexit. Of course, that was never going to happen anyway, but Brexit's a very convenient excuse. So you're going to see higher deficits if they're smart and they try and stimulate the economy, given that, you know, the proverbial is about to hit the fan. Deficits will probably go up. So you're looking at UK public debt in the medium term, what, 100% of GDP? 100% of GDP, declining demand, increasing prices, recession. That is a very difficult situation to handle.
It sounds like the 70s, but without punk rock.
Yeah, right. I mean, it looks horrific, quite frankly. And actually, what's most interesting is that, you know, much of the public isn't really aware of that. They're sort of waiting for it. But what's really weird is that the political class doesn't seem aware of it. I mean, you know, the whole thing around Labour, oh, let's get Angela Eagle and she'll make us electable. I don't think they, A, understand the secular problem for social democracy, the problems that they face as a centre-left party generally, but then the specific problems of the British economy. The British establishment on every side just appears totally, totally, totally unprepared for this.
I'm speaking with the journalist Aaron Bastani, founder of Novara Media. Okay, you mentioned Labour. Let's turn to that party, which is also in profound disarray. And as we speak, as we record this, the rebellion against Jeremy Corbyn is reaching something of a peak. We don't know what the result is going to be, but tell us what's going on within that party.
Labour last year elected Jeremy Corbyn as their new leader. The guy won a quarter of a million votes. He won a big mandate, huge mandate, not historically unprecedented. Some people get that wrong, but it was pretty big. He's the most left-wing Labour leader ever. He's probably one of the most left-wing MPs ever too. Ditto John McDonnell, his shadow chancellor. So two of the most left-wing Labour MPs ever are now the two top guys. In the last couple of weeks, he's basically faced a coup. This was triggered by him sacking Hillary Benn in the middle of the night. And then within a few days, we had resignations en masse from the shadow cabinet. I think within 3-4 days, we had a motion of no confidence passed by the Parliamentary Labour Party, 172 signatories, vast majority of the Parliamentary Party. So dozens of resignations from the shadow cabinet, 2/3, 3/4 of the Parliamentary Party not having any confidence in him. But he has a huge mandate from the membership, and the unions came out. All the major unions came out and said, we back the guy. So he said, well, I'm not going anywhere. And then yesterday, Angela Eagle announced she was running as a candidate, and she's going to get the requisite nominations to run for the leadership.
What are her politics?
She voted for the war. She voted against an investigation into the war. She abstained on the welfare reform bill last summer. So she's, you know, that hit the poorest very hard. It hits disabled people very hard. She abstained. She will say, you know, because she's a working class northern woman, a lesbian woman, she'll repeatedly say, I'm of the left, I'm working class. But her track record speaks for itself. And, you know, they're not particularly left-wing politics that she's advanced. This coup has been plotted by the right of the party really since Corbyn won. And many feel that Eagle is a front for them. So she's a front for more right-wing MPs, for Tristram Hunt, Chuck Umunna, and of course the Mephisto of the New Labour Project, Peter Mandelson, Alistair Campbell.
Now these are all alums of the Blair years, right? Yes.
Right. So she's seen as a kind of a front for these guys, and they thought she'd be the unity candidate. The idea that somebody who backed the war would be a unity candidate 2 weeks before the Chilcot report into the Iraq war, pretty stupid, but that's what they decided to do. We just did a great piece, by the way, on Novara Media. If you go to wired.novaramedia.com, on Angela Eagle's rise. So she's got a seat in Merseyside near Liverpool. And actually, she won that, I think, in the late 80s. And of course, Labour was going through a process of kind of detoxification with socialists. And she actually won it at the cost of a socialist activist. And we talk about what happened and how undemocratic it was and how it really crystallises so many of the issues with New Labour. But that will really clarify where she comes from, what her politics are.
This also sounds rather foreign to Americans, that the leader of the party is
elected by a membership. The party's a membership organization,
yeah.
And the MPs don't themselves elect the party leader, although they'd like to. Is this what's happening?
Harriet Hahn was the interim leader before Jeremy Corbyn, but the previously elected leader was a guy called Ed Miliband. Ed Miliband was chosen under the old system, so it was like a electoral college. It was one third parliamentary Labour Party, one third trade union bloc, one third membership. And then in 2014, there was a new system introduced, and it basically became one member, one vote. So the membership became sovereign in electing a new leader. So it's a very new system. Now, the right of the party loved this system. They championed it because they thought it would undermine the power of the unions. What they got 1 year later was the most left-wing leader the party's ever had. But it's quite new, and it's fantastic. I mean, it's a really great thing, but it's almost like a historical mistake of the Labour Party. If they'd known this would happen, they obviously never would have done it.
Now, he's brought in thousands of new members too, right?
Yeah, so the party, the last general election was May 2015, so what, 14 months ago. It was around 200,000 members then. It's now approaching 600,000. So the party has increased, I think it's actually more than three times since May 2015. Huge numbers of people joined to vote for his leader last summer. And then since he's faced this challenge 2-3 weeks ago, it's called the chicken coup, hashtag chicken coup, maybe 150,000 people have joined again, new people. So it's now, I believe, at a post-war high in terms of membership. It's touching 600,000.
There's been a lot of criticism of Corbyn for not handling the Brexit affair very well, that he probably in his heart of hearts was for Brexit, but had to be against it publicly and dithered in his leadership. Is that a fair characterization?
He was honest, I think. You know, I mean, I was for Brexit, and then I changed my mind because the short and medium-term overhead was so big. But he was honest about the problems with the EU. It's not wonderful. And he was asked on a Friday night chat show, how fond are you of the EU? He said 7.5. And people were like, oh, you should be saying 10. In terms of his failures as a leader to deliver the vote, I mean, the reason why Britain voted to leave the EU is because of Tory voters. So Labour voters, there's good polling on this. This is agreed really by all sides now. Labour voters were 63% Remain, 37% Leave. SNP voters, Scottish National Party voters, were 36% Leave. Yet Nicola Sturgeon is kind of feted as this incredibly talented leader, and Jeremy Corbyn seen as a failure. So the numbers don't really bear that out. What's more, there was very high turnout. We've only really discovered this in the last week. Surprisingly high turnout amongst 18 to 24s, who obviously voted overwhelmingly to remain. So Corbyn did pretty well. I mean, you know, to deliver 63% of the Labour vote for Remain is a decent achievement. So the numbers don't really stack up in terms of what they're saying.
That vote breakdown you described contradicts the presentation of Brexit as a working class rebellion.
Yeah, but it's a mixed bag, you know. I think it's surprising. There's some good data out there saying that 59% of Brexit voters were middle class the other day. But then again, what do you mean by middle class, right? Is it a working class revolt? Yes and no. I mean, turnout was incredibly high in some parts of the country which are economically isolated. So, you know, outside the metropolitan centre, further north. Great example, but Barnsley, Hartlepool, these aren't metropolitan areas, but they're big towns. And turnout was quite high, and a lot of them are in post-industrial areas. But yes, that wasn't just the Brexit vote. The Brexit vote was also quite affluent people in the southwest who have nice cars. I think the number one demographic to vote leave was people who've already paid off their mortgages. So basically, they viewed that there was no downside, no risk. So obviously, that's quite an affluent demographic in itself. There were elements of a working class rebellion. It wasn't exclusively that, though. No, it's 18 million people. There's a lot of demographics involved.
Okay, then back to the Labour Party. Obviously, we don't know what the results of this will all be. But if Corbyn is deposed, what will happen?
Well, today, the Labour National Executive Committee, right now, in fact, I'm at the offices of a place called Momentum, which is a Corbyn-friendly sort of organisation. And we're sort of keeping up to date with all this stuff. And the NEC's meeting today to decide whether Corbyn should be on the ballot automatically or not. Now, he probably will struggle to get the signatories to be on the ballot if he's not on it automatically. So this is a big deal. It looks like he'll be kept off. So it looks like the NEC, the number of votes you need to keep the guy off would be 17. So 17 votes. And by the way, the NEC historically has always voted with a show of hands. That's in the rule book. They've decided it will be a secret ballot. So 17 people in secret, and these include representatives of trade unions and so on and so forth. This is not a private citizen's, you know, plebiscite. This is people representing millions of people in some cases who will be voting under the rules of a secret ballot. 17 people in secret could be set to undermine the votes of 250,000. So that's what looks like will happen. It looks like he won't be on the ballot. The question then is, can his supporters get the signatures necessary for him to run? I think that looks quite difficult. But then everything so far has looked difficult, and he's met all the challenges put in front of him, so maybe this won't be any different.
But whatever the outcome of this, what we've just been talking about for the last 20 or so minutes, it seems like, well, you said as much earlier, that this is really a political system in absolute crisis, where people voted for something they don't quite understand. We have these leaderships of the parties completely out of touch with their bases and doing whatever they want to rather than actually doing anything resembling the democratic will of the people. Where will this go? I mean, it just seems like everything is falling to pieces.
Yeah, I mean, I think the primary issue here is obviously the party system that Britain has. So just like with the States, we have first past the post. And historically, we were told, well, look, that's not necessarily representative of the popular vote. But what it does mean is strong government and a mandate to govern and an opposition which can hold the government to account. Very clear, you know. So obviously, it gives rise to a two-party system. And what we're seeing with the rise of UKIP, with the rise of the SNP, with the rise of the Greens, with the rise of Plaid Cymru, but they're really a small player. They haven't really scaled like the SNP have in the last sort of 10 years. But, you know, we've got a five-party system now. And obviously the whole thing is set up to be a two-party system. So it's perfectly possible that Corbyn could win 11 million votes, right? 1.5 million more votes than Ed Miliband. And Labour could lose 40, 50 seats. Potentially. I'm not saying it's going to happen. Who knows what's going to happen? But that's plausible because UKIP would win seats in the north. The Lib Dems would win some more back in the south. Because those votes aren't in the right places, it doesn't make any difference. So the problem right now is we have an electoral system and a party system in absolute crisis. Now, the two-party system, again, just like with States, always meant that the Labour Party and the Tory Party, just like with the Democrats and the Republicans, were effectively coalitions. And you had people with very divergent politics in the same organisation. So if you look at Greece right now, you've got Topotami, you've got PASOK, and you've got Syriza. All three of these politics are in Labour right now. Okay. Now, that over the last couple of years in particular, now really since Jeremy Corbyn, it's becoming clear that this isn't really manageable. The problem is, of course, people aren't going to split because the electoral system doesn't favour it. But the management of centrist, moderate politics for Labour has become really, really difficult. You know, historically, the parameters of political possibility were managed, I would say, between... It was a partnership, really, between party leaderships, party elites, and the mainstream media. Now, in the last couple of years, that seems to have cracked, I think because of the crisis, but I also think because of the nationalist crisis here, which is very contextually specific to Britain, and also the rise of social media and new communications technologies, which, by the way, played a huge role in the rise of Corbyn, helped fund him, helped him communicate, helped him mobilise supporters. So... where do we go next? Absolutely no idea. I think the clearest political consequence of the last couple of weeks is probably the end of the union, right? That's something you can almost certainly bank on. Scotland, if it won't leave the union, will now have a totally separate parliament, I think. England will have an English parliament, and that would mean in England permanent Tory hegemony, even if Labour stays together, which I don't think will happen given what we're seeing right now. So, yeah, it doesn't look good. But the immediate consequence, I think, is huge economic, let's say, recession, for all the reasons I stated a little while ago, stagflation, like you say, 70s like the punk rock, and the end of the union. And I think that's being optimistic. I think things could actually get a lot worse. And for many of us here in Britain, you know, we've been involved in radical politics since, you know, since the crisis, since 2010, since 2011. We always thought that the interesting stuff in Europe was coming from Spain, from Italy, you know, Greece, whatever. But it turns out actually Britain is the most dysfunctional one of the lot.
That was journalist Aaron Bastani, founder of Novara Media. NOVARAmedia.com. After that interview was recorded, the National Executive Committee, the NEC, of the Labor Party, decided to keep Corbyn on the leadership ballot, but that decision has been challenged by a major donor to the party. So, still no resolution. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. I said in the Bastani interview that what he was describing sounded like the 1970s without punk rock. Well, here's a necessary supplement to make it all complete. An anthem of sorts. Till next week, bye.